Chapter 2. Swift and powerful, a great hammerhead shark 15 feet long glided gracefully through the air-clear water like a gray cloud drifting over a meadow. Its two bulging eyes gazed from the ends of a flat stabilizer that spread across its snout. They caught a motion and swiveled, focusing on a creature swimming through the coral forest below. The thing looked like no fish the hammerhead had ever seen. It had two parallel fins protruding to the rear and was colored black with red stripes along the sides. The huge shark saw nothing savory and continued its never-ending search for more appetizing prey, not realizing that the odd creature would have made a very tasty morsel indeed. Summer Pitt had noticed the shark but ignored it, concentrating on her study of the coral reefs inside Navidad Bank, 70 miles northeast of the Dominican Republic. The bank encompassed a dangerous stretch of reefs 30 by 30 square miles with depths varying from 3 to 100 feet. During the passage of 4 centuries, no less than 200 ships had come to grief on the unforgiving coral that crowned a seamount soaring from the abyssal depths of the Atlantic Ocean. The coral on this section of the bank was pristine and beautiful, rising in some areas as much as 50 feet off the sandy bottom. There were delicate sea fans and huge brain coral, their vivid colors and sculptured contours spreading into the blue void like a majestic garden with a myriad of archways and grottos. It seemed to Summer that she was swimming into a labyrinth of alleyways and tunnels, some becoming dead ends while others opened into canyons and crevasses large enough to drive a large truck through. Though the water was in excess of 80 degrees, Summer Pitt was fully encased from head to foot in a Viking Pro Turbo 1000 heavy-duty vulcanized rubber dry suit. She wore the black and red suit instead of a lighter wetsuit because it totally sealed every inch of her body, not so much as protection from the mild water temperature, but as a deterrent to the chemical and biological contamination that she had planned to encounter during her assessment and monitoring of the coral. She glanced at her compass and made a slight turn to the left, kicking her fins while clasping her hands behind and under her twin air tanks to reduce water resistance. Wearing the bulky suit and AGA Mark II full face mask made it seem easier to walk on the bottom than swim over it, but the often sharp and uneven surface of the coral made that nearly impossible. Her physical contours and facial features were shrouded by the baggy dry suit and full head mask. The only clues to her beauty were the exquisite gray eyes gazing through the face mask lens and a wisp of red hair that showed on her forehead. Summer loved the sea and diving through its unknown void. Every dive was a new adventure through an unknown world. She often imagined herself as a mermaid with salt water in her veins. Urged by her mother, she had studied ocean sciences. A top student, she graduated from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, where she had received her master's degree in biological oceanography. At the same time, her twin brother Dirk had achieved his degree in ocean engineering at Florida Atlantic University. Soon after they returned to their home in Hawaii, they were informed by their dying mother that the father they never knew was the special projects director for the National Underwater and Marine Agency in Washington, D.C. Their mother had never talked about him until she was lying on her deathbed. Only then did she describe their love and why she let him believe that she had died in an underwater earthquake 23 years before. Badly injured and disfigured, she thought it best that he live his life unencumbered without her. Several months later, she gave birth to twins. In memory of her undying love, she had named Summer after herself and Dirk after his father. After her funeral, Dirk and Summer flew to Washington to meet Pitt Sr. for the first time. Their sudden appearance came as a total shock to him. Stunned at confronting a son and daughter whom he had no idea existed, Dirk Pitt became overjoyed, having believed for more than 20 years that the unforgettable love of his life had long since died. But then he was deeply saddened to learn she had lived all these years as an invalid without telling him and had died only the month previously. Embracing the family he never knew he had, he immediately moved them into the old aircraft hangar where he lived with his huge classic car collection. When he was told that their mother had insisted they follow in his path and become educated in the ocean sciences, he orchestrated their employment with Numa. Now, after 2 years of working on ocean projects around the world, she and her brother had embarked on a unique journey to investigate and gather data on the strange toxic contamination that was killing the fragile sea life on Navidad Bank and other reefs throughout the Caribbean. Most parts of the reef system still teemed with healthy fish and coral. Brightly hued snappers mingled with huge parrotfish and groupers, while little iridescent yellow and purple tropical fish darted around tiny brown and red seahorses. Moray eels, looking fierce with their heads protruding out of holes in the coral, opened and closed their jaws menacingly, waiting to sink their needle teeth into a meal. Summer knew they only looked frightening because that was their method of breathing, since they did not have a set of gills on the back of their necks. They seldom attacked humans unless they were antagonized. To be bitten by a moray eel, one almost had to place a hand in its mouth. A shadow crossed above a sandy gap in the coral, and she looked up, half expecting to see the same shark returning for a closer look. But it was a flight of 5 spotted eagle rays. One peeled off the formation like an aircraft and cruised around Summer, staring curiously before swooping upward and rejoining the others. After traveling another 40 yards, she slipped over a formation of horny Gorgonian coral and came within view of a shipwreck. A huge 5-foot barracuda hovered over the debris, staring out of cold, black, beady eyes at all that took place in its domain. The steamship Vandalia was driven onto Navidad Bank in 1876 during a fierce hurricane. Of her 180 passengers and 30 crewmen, none survived. Listed by Lloyd's of London as lost without a trace, her fate remained a mystery until sport divers discovered her coral-encrusted remains in 1982. There was little left to distinguish Vandalia as a shipwreck. 130 years on the bank had covered her with anywhere from 1 to 3 feet of sea life and coral. The only obvious signs of what was once a proud ship were the boilers and engines that still protruded from the twisted carcass and exposed ribs. Most of the wood was gone, long rotted away by the salt water or eaten by critters of the sea that consumed anything organic. Built for the West Indies Packet Company in 1864, Vandalia was 320 feet from the tip of her bow to the jackstaff on her stern, with a 42-foot beam and accommodations for 250 passengers and 3 holds for a large amount of cargo. She sailed between Liverpool and Panama, where she unloaded her passengers and cargo for the rail trip to the Pacific side of the isthmus, where they boarded steamers for the rest of the journey to California. Very few divers had salvaged artifacts from Vandalia. She was difficult to find in her camouflaged position amid the coral. Little was left of the ship after being crushed that horrible night by the mountainous waves of the hurricane that caught her in the open sea before she could reach the safety of the Dominican Republic or nearby Virgin Islands. Summer roamed over the old wreck, carried by a mild current, looking down and trying to picture the people who had once trod her decks. She sensed a spiritual sensation. It was as if she was flying over a haunted graveyard whose inhabitants were speaking to her from the past. She kept a wary eye on the great barracuda that hung motionless in the water. Food was no problem for the ferocious-looking fish. There was enough sea life living in and around the old Vandalia to fill an encyclopedia on marine ichthyology. Forcing her mind from visions of the tragedy, she swam warily around the barracuda that never took a beady eye off her. A safe distance away, she paused to check the air left in her tanks on the pressure gauge, mark her position on a global positioning satellite mini-computer, eye the compass needle in relationship to the underwater habitat where she and her brother were living while studying the reef, and note the reading on her bottom timer. She felt slightly buoyant and neutralized by venting a bit of air from her back-mounted buoyancy compensator. Swimming another 100 yards, she saw the bright colors fading and the coral turning colorless. The further she swam, the more the sponges became glazed and diseased until they died and ceased to exist. The visibility of the water also dropped drastically until she could see no farther than the extended tip of her hand and fingers. She felt as if she had entered a dense fog. It was a phenomenon known as the mysterious brown crud that had appeared throughout the Caribbean. The water near the surface was an eerie brown mass that fishermen described as looking like sewage. Until now, no one knew exactly what caused the crud nor what triggered it. Ocean scientists thought it was associated with a type of algae, but had yet to prove it. Strangely, the crud did not appear to kill the fish like its notorious cousin, the red tide. They avoided contact with the worst of the toxic effects, but soon began to starve after losing their feeding grounds and shelter in the process. Summer noticed that the usually brilliant sea anemone, with their arms extended to feed in the current, also seemed hard hit by the weird invader to their realm. Her immediate project was simply to take a few preliminary samples. Recording the dead zone on Navidad Bank with cameras and chemical analysis instruments to detect and measure its composition would come later, in the hope of eventually finding countermeasures to eradicate it. The first dive of the project was purely one of exploration, to see firsthand the effects of the crud so she and her fellow marine scientists on board the nearby research ship could evaluate the full scale of the problem and create a precise pattern for future study of the cause. The first brown crud invasion warning had been sounded by a commercial diver working off Jamaica in 2002. The baffling crud had left a path of underwater destruction unseen and mostly unreported from the surface as it drifted out of the Gulf of Mexico and around the Florida Keys. That outbreak was, Summer was beginning to discover, much different than here. The crud on Navidad Bank was far more toxic. She began to find dead starfish and shellfish such as shrimp and lobster. She also noted that the fish swimming through the strange discolored water seemed lethargic, almost comatose. She removed several small glass bottles from a pouch strapped to one thigh and began taking water specimen samples. She also collected dead star and shellfish and dropped them in a netted bag attached to her weight belt. When the jars were sealed and securely resting in the pouch, she checked her air again. She had over 20 minutes of dive time left. She rechecked her compass readings and began swimming in the direction from which she had come, soon reaching clean and clear water again. Casually observing the bottom that had turned to a small river of sand, she sighted the opening to a small cavern in the coral, one she hadn't noticed before. At first glance, it looked like any one of 20 others she'd passed in the last 45 minutes. But there was something different about this one. The entrance had a square, cornered, carved look about it. Her imagination visualized a pair of coral-encased columns. A ribbon of sand led inside. Curious, and with an ample supply of air in reserve, she swam over to the entrance of the cavern and peered into the gloom. A few feet inside the chamber, the indigo of the walls flickered under the shimmering light from the sun's rays above. Summer slowly swam along the sandy bottom as the blue turned dark and became brown after several yards. She nervously turned and looked over her shoulder, reassuring herself at seeing brightness surrounding the opening. Without a dive light, there was nothing to see, and it didn't take great imagination to picture danger in the inky interior. She nimbly turned and stroked toward the entrance. Suddenly, one of her fins brushed against something half buried in the sand. She was about to simply dismiss it as a lump of coral, but the coral-encrusted object had a seemingly man-made symmetrical contour. She dug into the sand until the thing came free. Moving toward the light, Summer held it aloft and lightly swirled it in the water, cleaning away the sand. It looked to be about the size of an old-fashioned lady's hat box, except that it felt quite heavy, even underwater. Two handles protruded from the upper area, while the bottom gave the impression under the encrustation of having a pedestal base. As near as she could tell, the interior looked hollow, another sign that it wasn't created by nature. Through the mask, Summer's gray eyes mirrored skeptical interest. She decided to carry it back to the habitat, where she could carefully clean and determine what was to be seen under the accumulated coral sea growth. The extra weight of the mysterious object and the dead sea life she had collected on the bottom had affected her buoyancy, so she compensated by adding air to her BC. Tightly gripping the object under her arm, she languidly swam toward the habitat, oblivious of her air bubbles trailing behind her. The habitat that she and her brother would call home for the next 10 days appeared through the shimmering blue water a short distance ahead. Pisces was often called an inner space station, but she was an underwater laboratory designed and dedicated to ocean research. She was a 65-ton rectangular chamber rounded off on the ends, 38 feet long by 10 feet wide by 8 feet high. The habitat sat on legs attached to a heavy weighted base plate that provided a stable platform on the seafloor, 50 feet below the surface. The entry airlock served as a storage unit and a place to don and remove diving equipment. The main lock that maintained a differential pressure between the two compartments contained a small lab working area, a galley, a confined dining area, 4 bunk beds, and a computer and communications console connected to an outside antenna for contact with the world above the surface. She removed her air tanks and connected them with a bottom tank filling station next to the habitat. Holding her breath, she swam up and into the entry lock, where she carefully set the pouch and net containing her specimen samples in a small container. The mysterious coral-encrusted object she set on a folded towel. Summer was not about to risk the dangers of contamination. Suffering from the tropical heat and the sweat emerging from her insulated pores for a few more minutes were a small price to pay to avoid a potentially deadly illness. After swimming in and through brown crud, one drop on her skin could prove fatal. She did not dare remove her Viking dry suit with attached turbo hood and boots, gloves sealed by locking rings and full face mask just yet. After unsnapping her weight belt and buoyancy compensator, she turned on two valves that activated a strong sprinkling system, washing down her wetsuit and gear with a special decontamination solution to remove any brown crud residue. Certain she was properly sanitized, she turned off the valves and rapped on the door to the main lock. Although the masculine face that appeared on the other side of the viewport belonged to her twin brother, there was little resemblance. Though they were born within minutes of each other, she and her brother Dirk Jr. were about as non-identical as twins could get. He towered over her at 6'4" and was lean and hard and deeply tanned. Unlike her straight red hair and soft gray eyes, the thick mass of hair on his head was wavy and black, the eyes a mesmeric opaline green that sparkled when the light hit just right. When she stepped out of the chamber, he removed the yoke and collar seal between the neck of her suit and head mask. By the look in his eyes that were more piercing than usual and the grim expression on his face, she knew she was in big trouble. Before he could open his mouth, she threw up her hands and said, I know, I shouldn't have gone off alone without a dive partner. You know better, said her brother in exasperation. If you hadn't sneaked off at the crack of dawn before I was awake, I would have come after and dragged you back to the lab by your ear. I apologize, said Summer, feigning remorse, but I can accomplish more if I don't have to be concerned with another diver. Dirk helped her undo the heavy, riveted, waterproof zippers on her Viking dry suit. First removing the gloves and pulling the inner hood down behind her head, he began peeling the suit from her torso, arms and then legs and feet, until she could step out of it. Her hair fell in a cascade of copper red. Underneath, Summer wore a skin-tight polypropylene nylon bodysuit that nicely displayed her curvaceous body. "Did you enter the crud?" asked Dirk with concern in his tone. She nodded. "I brought back samples." "You certain there was no leakage inside your suit?" Holding her arms over her head, she did a pirouette. "See for yourself. Not a drop of toxic slime to be seen." Pitt put a hand on her shoulder. "Words to remember. Don't ever dive alone again. Certainly not without me if I'm in the neighborhood." "Yes, brother," she said with a condescending smile. "Let's get your samples in a sealed case. Captain Barnum can take them back to the ship's lab for analysis." "The captain is coming to the habitat?" she asked in mild surprise. "He invited himself for lunch," Pitt answered. "He insisted on delivering our food supplies himself. Said it will give him a break from playing ship's commander." "Tell him he can't come if he doesn't bring a bottle of wine." "Let us hope he got the message by osmosis," Dirk said with a grin. A cadaverously built man, Captain Paul T. Barnum, might have been taken for a brother to the legendary Jacques Cousteau, except that his head was almost desolate of hair. He wore a shorty wet suit and left it on after entering the main lock. Dirk helped him lift a metal box containing 2 days of food onto the galley counter where Summer began stowing the various supplies in a little cupboard and refrigerator. "I brought you a present," Barnum announced, holding up a bottle of Jamaican wine. "Not only that, the ship's cook made you a lobster thermidor with creamed spinach for dinner." "That explains your presence," Pitt said, slapping the captain on the back. "Spirits on a Numa project," Summer murmured mockingly. "What would our esteemed leader, Admiral Sandecker, have to say about breaking his golden rule of no booze during working hours?" "Your father was a bad influence on me," said Barnum. "He never came aboard ship without a case of vintage wine, while his buddy Al Giordino always showed up with a humidor filled with the Admiral's private stock of cigars." "It seems everybody but the Admiral knows that Al secretly buys the cigars from the same source," said Dirk, smiling. "What's for a side dish?" asked Barnum. "Fresh fish chowder and crab salad." Who's doing the honors? Me, muttered Dirk. The only seafood Summer can prepare is a tuna sandwich. That's not so, she pouted. I'm a good cook. Dirk gazed at her cynically. Then why does your coffee taste like battery acid? Pan-fried in butter, the lobster and cream spinach were washed down with a bottle of Jamaican wine, accompanied by tales of Barnum's seafaring adventures. Summer made a nasty face at her brother as she presented them with a lemon meringue pie she had baked in the microwave. Dirk was the first to admit she had performed a gourmet wonder, since baking and microwave ovens were not suited to one another. Barnum stood to take his leave when Summer touched his arm. I have an enigma for you. Barnum's eyes narrowed. What kind of enigma? She handed him the object she'd found in the cavern. What is it? I think it's some kind of pot or urn. We won't know until we clean off the incrustation. I was hoping you'd take it back to the ship and have someone in the lab give it a good scrubbing. I'm sure someone will volunteer for the job. He hoisted it in both hands as if weighing it. Feels too heavy for terracotta. Dirk pointed to the base of the object. There's an open space free of growth where you can see that it's formed out of metal. Strange. There doesn't appear to be any rust. Don't hold me to it, but my guess is it's bronze. The configuration is too graceful for native manufacture, added Summer. Though it's badly encrusted, it appears to have figures molded around the middle. Barnum peered at the urn. You have more imagination than I do. Maybe an archaeologist can solve the riddle after we return to port, if they don't go into hysterics because you removed it from the site. You won't have to wait that long, said Dirk. Why not transmit photos of it to Hiram Yeager in NUMA's computer headquarters in Washington? He should be able to come up with a date and where it was produced. Chances are it fell off a passing ship or came from a shipwreck. The Vandalia lies nearby, offered Summer. There's your probable source, said Barnum. But how did it get inside a cavern 100 yards away? Summer asked no one in particular. Her brother smiled fox-like and murmured, Magic, lovely lady. Voodoo Island magic. Darkness had settled over the sea when Barnum finally bid good night. As he slipped through the entry lock door, Pitt asked, How does the weather look? Pretty calm for the next couple of days, replied Barnum. But a hurricane is building up off the Azores. The ship's meteorologist will keep a sharp eye on it. If it looks like it's heading this way, I'll evacuate the two of you and we'll make full speed out of its path. Let's hope it misses us, said Summer. Barnum placed the urn in a net bag and took the pouch of water samples Summer had collected before he dropped out of the entry lock into the night-blackened water. Dirk switched on the outside lights, revealing schools of vivid green parrotfish swimming in circles, seemingly indifferent to the humans living in their midst. Without bothering to don air tanks, Barnum took a deep breath, beamed a dive light ahead of him, and stroked to the surface in a free ascent 50 feet away, exhaling as he rose. His little aluminum rigid hull inflatable boat bobbed on its anchor that he'd dropped earlier a safe distance from the habitat. He swam over, climbed in, and pulled up the anchor. Then he turned the ignition and started the 250-horsepower Mercury outboard motors and skimmed across the water toward his ship, whose superstructure was brightly illuminated with an array of floodlights, embellished with red and green navigation lamps. Most ocean-going vessels were usually painted white with red, black, or blue trim. A few cargo ships sported an orange color scheme. Not the Sea Sprite. As with all the other ships in the National Underwater and Marine Agency fleet, she was painted a bright turquoise from stem to stern. It was the hue the agency's feisty director, Admiral James Sandecker, had chosen to set his ships apart from the other vessels that roamed the seas. There were few mariners who didn't recognize a NUMA vessel when they passed one at sea or in port. Sea Sprite was large as her type of vessel went. She measured 308 feet in length with a 65-foot beam. State-of-the-art in every detail, she had started life as an icebreaker tug and spent her first 10 years stationed in and around the North Polar Seas, battling frigid storms while towing damaged ships out of ice floes and around icebergs. She could bulldoze her way through 6-foot-thick ice and tow an aircraft carrier through rough seas and do it with motion stability. Still in her prime when purchased by Sandecker for NUMA, he ordered her refitted into an ultra-multipurpose ocean research and dive support vessel. Nothing was spared in the major refurbishment. Her electronics were designed by NUMA engineers, as was her automated computerized systems and communications. She also possessed high-quality laboratories, adequate workspace, and low vibration. Her computer networks could monitor, collect, and pass process data to the NUMA laboratories in Washington for immediate investigation that turned the results into vital ocean knowledge. Sea Sprite was powered by the most advanced engines modern technology could create. Her two big magneto-hydrodynamic engines could move her through the water at nearly 40 knots. And if she could tow an aircraft carrier through turbulent seas before, she could now pull two without breathing hard. No research ship in any country in the world could match her rugged sophistication. Barnum was proud of his ship. She was only one of 30 research ships in the NUMA fleet, but easily the most unique. Admiral Sandecker had placed him in charge of her refit, and Barnum was more than happy to oblige, especially when the Admiral told him cost was no problem. No corner was cut, and Barnum never doubted that this command was the pinnacle of his Marine career. Deployed a full 9 months a year overseas, her scientists were rotated with every new project. The other 3 months were spent in voyaging to and from study sites, dock maintenance, and upgrading equipment and instruments with newer technical advances. As he approached, he gazed at the 8-story superstructure, the great crane on the stern that had lowered Pisces to the bottom and was used to lift and retrieve robotic vehicles and manned submersibles from the water. He studied the huge helicopter platform mounted over the bow and the array of communications and satellite equipment growing like trees around a large dome containing a full range of radar systems. Barnum turned his attention to steering alongside the hull. As he shut down the engines, a small crane swung out from above and lowered a cable with a hook. He attached the hook to a lift strap and relaxed as the little boat was lifted aboard. Once he stepped onto the deck, Barnum immediately carried the enigmatic object to the ship's spacious laboratory. He handed it to two intern students from the Texas A&M School of Nautical Archaeology. "Clean it up the best you can," said Barnum, "but be very careful. It just might be a very valuable artifact." "Looks like an old pot covered with crud," said a blonde-haired girl wearing a tight Texas A&M t-shirt and cut-off shorts. It was obvious that she didn't relish the job of cleaning it. "Not at all," said Barnum with icy menace. "You never know what vile secrets are hidden in a coral reef, so beware of the evil genie inside." Happy to have the last word, Barnum turned and walked toward his cabin, leaving the students staring suspiciously at his back before turning and contemplating the urn. By 10 o'clock that evening, the urn was on a helicopter heading toward the airport at Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic, where it would be put on a jetliner whose destination was Washington, D.C.